On case 84161, Range Bank National Trust Company versus Fidelity. Counsel, would you state your appearances for the arguing today?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Derek Brenner, from the Dry Company Foundation.
All right, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Scott Brenner, and with me is Joe Reynolds, who's here on behalf of Alta. And I would like to have a question.
I can't really hear.
All right, thank you. Are all counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's get started. Counsel, will you be reserving any time for rebuttal?
I will be. I'd like to attempt to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, excellent.
All right, if I may proceed. May it please the court, Darren Brenner for appellate, Deutsche Bank. The court committed reversible error when it found no coverage under the policy's Form 100 and 115.2 endorsements. Before we discuss the endorsements in detail, some context is in order. It's often said that title insurance policies are retrospective in nature, and generally that is true. But several decades ago, the title insurance industry figured out it could make an extra buck by marketing and selling these endorsements that expand the scope of coverage beyond their typical terms. And in this case, Fidelity sold two such endorsements that are relevant, the Form 100 and the Form 115.2. Fidelity's own guidelines summarize the coverage that these endorsements provide succinctly, and I read from pages 227 and 273 of the record. Form 100 provides comprehensive coverage for present or future CC&R violations. Form 115.2 more directly provides coverage for future assessments. Because the endorsements are an upsell that add additional coverage to the policy, it is universally understood that the endorsements overcome the pre-printed exclusions and the Schedule B exceptions to the contrary. That point's not disputed, and in fact, it's acknowledged in the underlying briefs, page 812. But that's exactly what Fidelity did when it denied the claims in these cases. Specifically, Fidelity claimed that the HOA's lien was post-policy and therefore excluded by 3D. Fidelity claimed that the HOA's lien was assessed pursuant to the CC&Rs and therefore accepted by Schedule B, Exception 10, which we will come back to because that was important. And Fidelity also claimed that the loss was caused by the law rather than the CC&Rs, which, although not named in its denial, is Exclusion 1A in the policy, as the District Court recognized in footnote 4 of its order in Fidelity in its underlying briefs at page 809. Fidelity knew it was violating the policy and the law when it applied these exclusions and the exemptions to the endorsements. I read from Fidelity's endorsement guide at page 277 of the record. Endorsements will provide additional coverage for matters which would be ordinarily excluded or accepted from coverage by Schedule B. Fidelity's act of denying claims by applying exclusion and exemption to the endorsement in case after case, and I know your honors are aware that there are now hundreds of these. Fidelity's act of denying this in case after case when it knows you can't apply the exclusions and the exception to the endorsement, it's textbook institutional bad faith. It's a strategy designed to disenfranchise insureds so that they will just go away rather than confront Fidelity and its Fortune 500 legal juggernaut apparatus, where even its claim handlers are licensed attorneys. And not without resounding success. Here we are 9 years post-claim, and we haven't even made it past the pleading stage. That it takes the resources of a literal bank to push back on this type of conduct should be concerning, as your average insured is unlikely to have those same resources. A final point of context before I talk about the endorsements specifically. And an issue that hasn't been disputed on appeal, the district court erred when it said the policy should not be construed in the insured's favor. Fidelity tries to minimize the error by saying it only matters if the policy is ambiguous. But that's a woefully incomplete statement of law when we are in the insurance policy setting. In this setting, we construe provisions to afford the greatest possible coverage to the insured and narrowly construe limiting language. And on top of that, as this court has said repeatedly, to limit coverage, the insurer must use clear and distinct language, demonstrate that its interpretation is the only reasonable construction from the viewpoint of one not trained in the law, and establish that limiting language plainly applies to a particular case. I'll circle back to that as we go forward, but with that context in mind, let's turn to the endorsements. Form 100 broadly covers any loss caused by reason of the existence of CC&Rs. There's no HOA, no assessment lien, no foreclosure, and no loss without the CC&Rs that were existing at date of policy. Fidelity's argument that the loss was caused solely by the law is not credible. We need look no further than Fidelity's own denial to see that it knows the loss is traceable to the CC&Rs. I read from pages 639 and 642 of the record. The company has completed its investigation. The HOA encumbrances were assessed pursuant to the CC&Rs that were explicitly listed in Schedule B. And there's another important point of context here. They recognize the risk the CC&Rs created. That's why they put it in Schedule B to exclude it, only to tell their insured, but you pay some more money and we will provide you these endorsements that insure over the exception.
Mr. Brenner, let's talk about Form 100 then. So under 1A of that endorsement, which I think is at least one of the provisions you're relying on, it talks about providing insurance for loss or damage by reason of the existence of, and under A, the CC&Rs, under which the lien of the mortgage referred to in Schedule A can be cut off, subordinated, or otherwise impaired. So what part of the covenant's conditions or restrictions is there that you can point to under which the lien of the mortgage can be cut off, subordinated, or impaired?
All right, so if I may answer that in two portions and start with this. You're going back to what I said before. We have to construe coverage broadly. And broadly means that all we need is the existence of CC&Rs because that is what creates perfection.
So you can just ignore the rest of the provision?
I think if you take that statement out, it would make no sense. If you take the by which, the under which out, then you'd have to change the language some other way. But let me go on to more to your point, Your Honor. The CC&Rs, you know, yes, there was a mortgage savings clause, but it was void ab initio. The law was already on the books. We don't go through these cases talking about, are we going to void it particularly for this case? It's void ab initio. Your honors have said that repeatedly. You said the lenders can't rely on it. So certainly the experts we hired to advise us on title shouldn't be able to rely on it either.
No, but it helps make the point that in fact the CC&Rs don't have a provision under which the mortgage can be cut off, subordinated, or otherwise impaired.
I respectfully disagree with that conclusion, Your Honor. We've got Section 5.1 of the CC&Rs, which establish the assessment covenant. And then we have Section 14.1.
Say that again.
Section 5.1 of the CC&Rs establish the assessment covenant. That okay. is the provision under which we are impaired. You know, I don't think that anybody would dispute that if there was delinquency prior to date of policy, that there would be coverage under this by virtue of that assessment covenant. But, Your Honor, here's the other point. This was all risk that was known to them. Section 14.1 of the CC&Rs is the severance provision. And it says if any provision of this is not enforceable because of the law, all other provisions are. And here is the real key, and maybe I should have led with this to answer your question. I think it's Section 512. I can find it again when I do my rebuttal. But it says, that section says that the HOA can foreclose consistent, you know, to the full ability of the law, which includes foreclosing on a lien, even if it extinguishes a first deed of trust. So when we come back down and we bring it back to the insurance principles that we have to apply, there's an exclusion in 1A for loss caused by the law. The endorsements override that. If you want to tell your insured, who we have to construe this from the viewpoint of one not trained in the law, that no, if it's caused by the law, that it's still excluded, you need an exclusion. And we know Fidelity knows how to do that. There's three exclusions listed at the bottom.
But we don't get to the exclusions unless it's covered by the...
Well, I mean, are we applying that as if it's limiting language? And here's the other...
I'm applying it as if it's the language of the provision of the contract.
Well, this is the other thing I would politely remind the court of. And while, though I know not binding on this court, you know, Judge Due recently held that it's a symbiotic loss. And it also follows the Ninth Circuit, who aptly observed in Mahogany Meadows that it's the CC&Rs and the and NRS 116 operating together that create the loss. You can't have one without the other. You have to have both. If you don't have CC&Rs, and Your Honor, the reason why the assessment covenant is sufficient, you don't need assessments to have an HOA. I mean, you can look at these own CC&Rs to see that. It prohibits, you can't have chickens in your yard. You can't have walls in your yard. You don't need assessments to do that. The statute says the CC&Rs may include an assessment obligation. That assessment obligation is perfected at recording of the CC&Rs. And if I can move on to the coverage provided under paragraph 2A of Form 100, it is straightforward. It covers any future violations on the land of any CC&Rs. There's no dispute that the loss here traces to the assessed to a violation of the assessment covenant. The primary issue here is whether the assessment covenant is
Mr.
on.
Mr. Hunter, would you consider that on the land? It just seems like that doesn't apply here at all.
Well, I would refer Your Honor to the covered CC&Rs, which expressly stated section 5.1, that the assessment obligation shall be a charge on the land. For time considerations, I'm going to have to refer to my briefing, but I will say this briefly. Covenants and the law surrounding covenants goes back millennia to feudal times, and our first published decisions are from 500 years ago. The issue has always been, was a covenant on the land, meaning that it binds the current owner and passes to the next, or was it merely a personal obligation such that, you know, when the vassal passed away and their successors took it, that they were also bound by that. So yes, Your Honor.
What was the paragraph of the CC&Rs that you just referred Justice Bell to?
It is 5.1, page 540 to 541 on the record. In the full statement, it gets better than that. It says, shall be a charge on the land and a continuing lien upon the lot. So if Fidelity wanted to limit coverage to so-called physical violations, a term that appears nowhere in the policy, by the way, it was required to draft a clear and distinct limitation, particularly where the very CC&Rs paragraph 2A invokes expressly say that the assessment obligation is on the land. We think on the land means what it's meant for millennia. But even if it doesn't, when you've got covered CC&Rs that say one thing, they need to provide a clear and distinct exclusion that says, no, not in this case. It's physical attributes. That's the only thing that we cover.
Counsel, do you want to reserve the rest of your time? You have 3 minutes.
And let me just say one thing. I'm not going to get a chance to comment on the 115. Even if this court decides that there is no coverage, in hindsight, after the fact, as we briefed, legal uncertainty, just like factual uncertainty, is enough to trigger the duty to defend. And in Nautilus, this court explained that our law forcefully requires insurers to defend even doubtful and disputed claims that may not be covered. In Century Surety, this court explained that an insurer in this situation has two options, defend under a reservation of rights or seek declaratory relief. In failing to defend or seek declaratory relief and causing this issue to come to the court now, 9 years later, there's a per se breach of the duty to defend. And really, that's what this case is all about. Thank you.
May it please the court, Scott Reddy on behalf of Fidelity. I just want to begin by reiterating what this court stated in its 2014 SFR decision, that the losses here that we're talking about were of the lender's own making. Deutsche Bank is asking this court, in an effort to recoup its losses, to effectively turn this title insurance policy into mortgage protection insurance, which guaranteed that borrowers with whom the title company has no relationship whatsoever would not default on HOA assessments for upwards of 30 years, and that the mortgage holders themselves would not take their own actions in order to prevent these types of losses. Deutsche Bank is asking this court to believe that the entire title industry offered this type of policy for a one-time small premium. In this case, it was $621 to effectively convert these title policies into mortgage protection insurance. In doing so, Deutsche Bank is asking this court to find coverage where clearly none exists. And probably the most powerful statement that this court has before it is the amicus brief from Alta, the very trade group that drafted these endorsements. And Alta has unequivocally stated that these endorsements do not and were never intended to provide coverage for these types of losses. Moving into the actual endorsements, first with the 101A, as this court's already noted, this covers loss of the mortgage sustained by reason of the existence of a covenant, condition, or restriction which causes loss of the mortgage. And one thing I want to make clear here is that the covenants, conditions, and restrictions that this endorsement refers to is not the document that we commonly think of as the Declaration of CC&Rs. If you look through this endorsement, it's talking about just generically covenants, conditions, and restrictions. And again, what Deutsche Bank has failed to do is point to any covenant, condition, or restriction which can actually cut off the mortgage. There is no such covenant. And, you know, it's important to note that the CC&Rs in the statute are actually at odds with respect to this issue. The CC&Rs were meant and actually have language that protect the mortgage. It's only through application of the statute itself that the mortgage can be lost, and that's what happened in this case. And this court's 2018 decision in Bank of America versus SFR, as well as at least four other cases from this court, make that clear. And I just want to briefly quote from Bank of America versus FSR, where this court stated, a statutory lien is created and defined by the legislature. The character, operation, and extent of a statutory lien are ascertained, and this is the court's word, solely from the terms of the statute. And this court went on to say, HOA liens created under NRS Chapter 116 are statutory liens, and thus enforcement of the lien is governed by statute.
Right, but by the same token, without CC&Rs, 116 would not be in play.
That is true. I mean, if there were no home in an HOA here, then you're right, we never get to the statute. But again, we're talking about what caused the loss of the mortgage. And you can't point to any covenant, condition, or restriction which can actually cut off the mortgage.
Counsel, could you explain when in CLTA Form 115.2, Section 2, when would that apply?
That would apply, let me make sure we're talking about the same.
It's the priority of any lien for charges and assessment at date of policy in favor of any association.
That would apply in a situation where you had, for example, one example would be if there was an assessment default at date of policy. At that point, there would be a priority lien under the statute. And so that provision would provide coverage under that scenario. Here, in other words, if there was an assessment default when escrow closed, then under the statute, there would already be an existence of priority lien. So that's the scenario where that particular endorsement provides coverage. Here, we're talking about...
So your point is that the homeowner needed to be in default at the time of the policy's issuance?
Correct. That's typically what that provision is meant to cover. Again, these issues don't come up very often because the title insurer does its research and homework beforehand, and if it sees, in theory, it would see that there was an assessment default and it would deal with that
issue. Which is why it's willing to insure against that act.
Exactly. So,
how would it know whether there was a default if it hadn't been noted yet?
Well, part of their underwriting would be to inquire about that. And so in theory, they would inquire of the HOA, knowing that this house isn't an HOA. They would inquire, probably make a written request to make sure there is no assessment default. And
at the escrow.
Through the escrow, right. This is all, and again, we're talking about typically title policies. Coverage doesn't come up very often because the homework is done ahead of time. So they're meant to cover unique situations that arise that people just didn't see. And here we're not talking about one of those situations. We're talking about assessment defaults that happened, in this case, 8 years after the policy was issued.
But just to be clear, it would be enough that the homeowner is in default. It doesn't require that the notice of default on the HOA lien have been recorded.
Well, I think that could potentially be an issue because if you read the statute literally, it says that the 9 months of priority is triggered based on the recording of the notice of default in the election to sell. So if there was no recording of the notice of default in the election to sell, then, you know, strictly under the statute, you wouldn't have a priority lien at that point.
So you would say then that that would change your reading of subparagraph 2 on CLTA 115.2? In other words, it says the priority of any lien for charges and assessments at date of policy, the due diligence would be a research as to notice of default by the HOA.
And I think it's also typical for escrows to actually just inquire, you know, what the status of HOA assessments are. Okay. That would be standard in the industry.
And so when do you say is that 115.2 sub 2 triggered by the due date of the assessments, or is it triggered by only when there's a super priority?
It's triggered if there is a super priority lien at data policy. In other words, if at data policy, the HOA lien has priority over the mortgage per the statute, that would trigger coverage.
Because only a super priority would have the potential to cause the loss of the mortgage.
Correct. Correct. So the whole point is the super priority has to exist at data policy. That's what the language of the endorsement says. And in this case, we didn't have that.
And then how do you deal with the provision in Chapter 116 that talks about the perfection, which establishes priority being based on the recording of the CCNRs, which, of course, is much sooner?
Yeah, and perfection, again, we're talking about really an inchoate lien. Perfection is not priority. Perfection only speaks of the fact that, you know, if in the future you have the right to record a notice of default, an election to sell, or notice of default, then that was considered perfected based on the recording of the CCNRs. But again, that has nothing to do with priority, which is the trigger in this case for coverage under the 115.2.
But do you think that the policy excludes inchoate liens from coverage? It doesn't by its express terms.
Well, if it was a post-policy, yes. But if it was a pre-policy, then no, it wouldn't be excluded. But again, we're
under what provision would an inchoate lien be excluded by the plain language of your policy?
I don't think an inchoate lien that existed at data policy, I don't think would be excluded under the general terms of the policy. But again, there's not a coverage issue there. There's no loss. And so you have to somehow find that whatever it is has turned into a loss that's covered. And the fact that there was a perfected inchoate lien, because that's what the statute says, doesn't lead to coverage under any policy provisions or endorsement in and of itself. You still have to have an event that causes that inchoate lien to obtain super priority status. And that's what is governed strictly by the statute in this case.
I'm not sure I caught that. So when does a super priority lien have inchoate status in your view?
Oh, a super priority lien doesn't have inchoate status.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, but the HOA lien, I guess the sub-priority.
Yeah, even the creation of an HOA lien is controlled strictly by what the statute says. Subsection 1 of the statute explains when an HOA lien is created. And then the other provisions of the statute discuss the lien created under subdivision 1. So the lien is actually created by the statute itself. Again, we're only talking about perfection. And so, in other words, to have the lien, they don't have to record or do anything. It's considered perfected. And again, that's also governed by the statute, by the way.
Inchoate lien exists as of the date of the CCNRs. That's what you just told me a moment ago.
That's what the statute says.
Yeah.
The statute says that the
recording. So you're splitting when it becomes super priority as the exclusion point.
Well, not just that. It's also, there's a difference between an inchoate lien that exists for purposes of perfection and the creation of an actual lien. And if you read the statute, again, subsection 1 of the statute explains how a lien is created, how an HOA lien is created under the statute. It's when an assessment becomes due. So it would make no sense to conclude, at least for purposes of the statutory lien, which caused this loss, that lien existed upon the recording of the CCNRs.
And how would you deal with the commentary on the Uniform Act, I guess, subsequent to Nevada's adoption of the act and the changes that were made therein, and our obligation to interpret the Uniform Act in accord with other Uniform Act states?
Well, the most important point is that the key provisions that have been cited were the 1994 amendments, which removed certain language in order to try and change the meaning. Nevada didn't adopt that.
Well, but it wasn't trying to change the meaning. According to the drafters, they said that they were trying to clarify ambiguity and to make clear that the UCIOA covers inchoate liens similar to real estate taxes or mechanics liens. And mechanics liens are a little more confusing, but a real estate lien is potentially there if there's money owed.
Right, but again, Nevada didn't adopt those amendments, and we don't know why they didn't, but we can presume that it's because they didn't want to and they rejected them. And
I don't think that that's presumed. That's a bit of a reach.
Yeah, so all I can say is, you know, a plain reading of the statute, and there's nothing in the Nevada legislative history anywhere which would indicate that they had any intent to come to those same conclusions, at least in 1994.
Can you just circle back, and I apologize to ask the same question twice, but where in your policy is an inchoate lien excluded?
Well, again, the policy is talking about really pre- and post-policy. So if a lien came into existence post-policy, it would be excluded. If it was a pre-policy lien, then, in theory, the title company would know of it and would not insure it if there was a risk of potential loss arising from that. But there isn't
any... policy does not exclude inchoate liens existing as of the date of the policy.
It does not expressly exclude a pre-policy
inchoate lien.
Yeah. There's no language in the policy that would say that. But again, that's not what caused the loss in this case.
But I understand that.
Right. And I just want to briefly touch on the trade usage, given my limited time, unless the court has any other questions. I think a couple of things that are important to note about the trade usage argument. And one, again, we have the trade group here that drafted the endorsements that said these endorsements don't cover these types of losses. And second, when you're talking about trade usage, you're talking about what is this, how is this trade treated, this endorsement? And here, I think we have to ask ourselves, in the trade it was common to cover these types of losses through these endorsements, why has every single insurance company that has addressed this issue denied coverage for these losses? I think with that and with Alta's point here, that puts any trade usage issue to rest, because the trade usage doesn't support what Deutsche Bank says it does. And I see I'm just about out of time, so unless the court has any questions, I will submit.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Why don't I start with where counsel left off with the trade usage? In a very small number of claims, Fidelity did accept, and there are other insurers who did accept their duty to defend. In fact, your next arguments with Mr. Stern and Mr. Girard, I've been co-counsel with Mr. Girard, where he was retained by Fidelity. That would be part of the record that they know there is a duty to defend if we hadn't been cut off at the knees at the pleading stage to prove that. The trade usage, this court has clearly said, trade usage is admissible to determine if a policy is ambiguous. Or a contract is ambiguous, and the district court just flatly got that wrong. Hasn't been disputed. The other thing that hasn't been disputed to this day, we still apply the general insurance policy presumptions, where we have to look at this for how the reasonable insured would, and I would submit that to the extent this court is struggling to understand the meaning of these provisions, how would the average insured, from the viewpoint of one not trained in the law, handle it? And that really brings us to the trade usage. I mean, there's a suggestion that we should accept Fidelity's version of facts because Alta provided an amicus brief. You know, as we've cited in the record, we cited the writings of James Gosden, the immediate past chair who's still on the committee and has been for two decades, that drafted these forms. I'm not going to read the citations, but they're in.
I'm sorry. Would you expect that year 29 of a 30-year mortgage, that if somebody quit paying their HOA fees, that the title insurance would cover that?
Yes, absolutely, and I'll tell you exactly why. Schedule B identifies the risk. First of all, these policies don't go on in perpetuity. They have a finite end. They end when the lien ends. But Schedule B recognizes the risk that the CCNRs create, and then they insure over it. Premium that they charge, we have nothing to do with that. That is totally on them. And keep in mind, they're doing this hundreds of thousands and millions of times over. And as big of an issue as this was to us, it's still a very small percentage of the homes. But if they didn't charge the right premium, that has nothing to do with us. The policy says what it says, and we enforce the policy as drafted.
Mr. Brenner, isn't Schedule B exclusions from coverage?
Schedule B, yes. And so we look at the...
Sorry, Chief.
May I finish answering? Sure. It is an exclusion from coverage that shows that they recognize the risk. And as has not been disputed, the endorsements insure over that. So if they had a problem with the premium, which isn't in evidence, charge a higher premium. If they don't want to insure it, it is so blisteringly simple. Don't sell the endorsements. Last point I'll make, and then I'll be quiet. When we talk about and it's answering the question, if I may. Would you rather I stop in order?
Yeah, if it's a new point. Then
I think it ties to the premium question, if I may. They've got, and we see it in Infidelity's manual cited in the record, they've got the Alta 5, which is what we have in this case, and they have the Alta 5.1. The Alta 5.1 limits coverage the way they're suggesting to assessments that are due and payable, yet another indication that they knew the risk they were taking on. They wanted the business from the bank, so they sold the version of the form that provided coverage that their own manuals admit includes future assessments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you, Counsel, for your arguments. That matter will stand submitted. We're going to take a brief recess to reconstitute the court for the next argument. Thank you.